on. And in celebration, it's my great pleasure to welcome Warren Weiss, general partner at Foundation Capital and a veteran of our industry. I've known Warren for many, many, many years. And in our conversation, you will often hear me addressing Warren as Bunny, because that's his nickname and that's his industry nickname. Everybody knows his nickname. So welcome, Bunny.
Thank you. Great to be with you. Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. So today we're going to talk about a variety of different things, and hopefully in 30 minutes, you know, get a lot of knowledge out of Bunny's vast experience and fertile head into the audience's eager, anxious head. So let's start with your kind of overview of and synthesis of what do you feel right now about the, you know, industry, about ventures, about how to build these unicorn companies. What have you learned? What have you seen? And what are you thinking about opportunities of for future unicorns?
Yeah, great. Thank you. You know, that's a broad, we could spend 30 minutes on that question, but to kind of net it out for you, it's really a great time to be in very early stage venture, which is what Foundation Capital does. And the reasons are that disruptions are at every level of the enterprise. And we not only see that in the enterprise side of venture, but also in the consumer side. And it's primarily driven by mobility and being able to have conferences and the freedom to do the things that you're doing just today in this session. So for Foundation Capital, I focus on the enterprise market. Every space of that market's being reinvented. What we've known as security in the past, where you built the higher and higher wall to keep the bad guys out, is completely broken. There is no perimeter. So it's a great opportunity in security to build a unicorn-like company, and some of the examples in your book point that out. Analytics is also being reinvented with high-speed databases, cloud computing, user interfaces that look like consumer sites from a consumption standpoint are incredibly exciting. We've seen the explosion of apps in the SaaS market as well, and just the whole cloud computing stack itself, where you're lowering the cost of everything from bare metal computing to databases to operating systems. All of that's getting compressed tremendously, so it leaves entrepreneurs with just a very unique opportunity to start companies for hundreds of thousands of dollars that took $10 and $20 million just a decade ago.
So let's talk about a couple of your portfolio companies where you have had, you know, significant success. And what I want to understand is, again, a synthesis of what parameters have made them so successful.
Right. The classic thing in venture capital, it's all about large markets, large markets, large markets. There are many other attributes that make up a successful company that can get to $1 billion in market cap. But if it's not a large market, it's very difficult to make it happen. So I would encourage your entrepreneurs to really be intellectually honest about the market size. Two of the most recent examples that I would use, my partner Charles Moldau, who's on a board of a company called Lending Club, which went public in mid-December, it became very obvious that the financial services market was yearning for a different way to do lending, for consumer lending, for loans, you know, that average around $25,000. If for those of you that even start businesses, that either try to get a small business loan or a personal loan, the hassles that you have to go through with a bank to get this done, especially when you're building intellectual property that doesn't initially have a lot of value like a tangible asset, you find it impossible to get your business off the ground. So, you know, even for folks that want something as low as, you know, combining their credit card or buying a car, you know, Lending Club is a company that obviously was in a multi-trillion dollar market. And the disruption in this case was for the company to build a marketplace where you could be both a lender and you could be a borrower. And the match between those, as we know, in marketplaces is incredibly efficient. So the ability to lend money and get a higher rate of return that you get from your bank substantially, the rate of return as a lender depends upon the risk that you're willing to take. And they have a whole credit risk system. And then on the lender side, it's a very simple process to be able to get involved based on your credit score and so forth. And so, you know, in a very short period of time, minutes, you can complete a transaction where you get a loan. We have a very low default rate in the company. It's now a public company, so you can see all this data. And that disruption is in a multi-trillion-dollar industry. And examples, another example of those is a company called OnDeck, which we're a small investor that also went public, that does small business loans. We're involved in a company called Ox Money in Germany that's like the Lending Club of Germany. My partner Charles started a mortgage loan services company for kind of loans $250,000 under called Lending Home. And so the macro trend here was that we saw just tremendous disruption, an easier way to acquire customers, service customers, and actually a lower risk and lower default rate from a traditional bank. And so we see that as cyclical cycle that'll spend the next 10 to 20 years playing out. And it's very exciting for entrepreneurs. And, you know, Bitcoin obviously has opportunities in those markets as well. And that's just one recent example.
So it sounds like one of the strategies your firm is following is analyzing a macro trend and making multiple bets on that industry.
Yes. You know, we're trying to go deep in certain areas. In marketing technologies, you know, we see this as kind of the decade of the CMO, and so CMOs will spend more to automate their business than possibly CIOs. There's been many studies to do that. You know, the technology now exists to integrate massive amounts of, we always hear about big data, and it's really about big results, not big data. And so things like marketing technologies and financial services are two spaces that we're primarily interested in diving very deep on. You can't be an expert at everything. And so if you're looking to raise capital from venture folks, you really need to not only look at the firm, look at the partner's experience and how they might be able to assist you to build a company.
And you also invested quite a bit in clean tech or IT as it pertains to clean tech. Can
yes.
you comment on that? Of course, you know, Silicon Valley fell in love with clean tech for a while, and then that ran out so well, and there are very few investors still investing in clean tech, but you have
right.
reasonably successful in clean tech, so talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thanks. It's a fun question to poke at. The word clean tech always kind of obfuscated what I thought was a potential market. There's really two kinds of investing that we've been successful at in that market. One is around digital energy, so transforming the electric grid, gas and water grids into a digital two-way network that communicates and senses with the network. And I've been involved in Silver Spring Networks for about 12 years now. It's the largest smart grid company in the world. But it's really transforming it into an Internet of Things market. We knew as connectivity would take places to any, you know, we see it in personal Fitbits and all kinds of devices. There's going to be trillions and trillions of devices that are connected and sensed and monitored and monetized through the Internet, through cellular infrastructures. That was one form of that where, we, you know, it was just obvious to us, just like in the days when Sun said the network is the computer, that the grid needed, you know, it's the most complex system ever built in the world, the electric grid, but it's 100 years old and it was completely outdated from a monitoring and managing standpoint. The other market that we've been very successful in is at the intersection of financial services and what basically solar as a service. We have two companies. One is a company here in the United States based in California called Sunrun. And it's a residential solar as a service market. So what it does is it makes solar affordable for people that couldn't afford the outlay to put in all the solar infrastructure on their home. And there's various different programs ranging from zero money down to as much as $25,000 to buy your own system. But what they do is they become your energy company. They sit between you and your utility. Your solar power is sold back to the utility itself, and so from the first month, you can start making, you know, terrific savings. And they sign, you know, 20-year long contracts, and the backlog that's built as a result of that looks more like a traditional financial services companies, but they operate it, run it for you, and make it very seamless. And we also have a similar company in India called Azure Power. It's the largest solar as a service to the commercial and industrial marketplace in India. As you know, India hungers for energy, and the cleaner the energy, the better. The Indian government has done a tremendous job with initiatives to have clean solar. And so Azure Power is another company that is the largest independent company of solar as a service to those marketplaces, and we expect great things and from both those companies. And the real gem here is seeing that there was a new way to do business. So it doesn't only have to be a intellectual property breakthrough, it can be an innovative business model breakthrough that allows millions and millions of customers to participate in something they couldn't afford or didn't understand, didn't have access to. And so all three of those examples are things we've been very successful in. Another, it was another deep focus for the firm starting back a decade ago.
So I hear a theme in what you've described of financial services, creative ways of playing the finance gaps or you know, issues in the financial services market. So I want to ask you for your thoughts on the small business financing market. And I know OnDeck to some extent plays in that market for a particular category of companies. Lending Club even borders on a little bit of that market, although it's primarily consumer lending. What we see, you know, we work with very large numbers of small entrepreneurs. Yeah. And while there's a bit of a bubble in the angel financing, seed financing area right now, but, you know, like in 2013, there were 70,000 angel finance companies, and then there were only 1,000 venture finance companies. The truth is, if you look at the exit-oriented angel financing model, 70,000 exits are not going to happen.
Right.
That's not viable. And, right. And 50,000 venture financings are not going to happen. However, you know, if you can get, you know, $250,000, $250,000, maybe up to even $1.5 million in the hands of small entrepreneurs, they can build robust businesses. They won't build necessarily venture capital style businesses or scale businesses, but they will build robust $5 million, $10 million businesses. And that is a complete underserved or unserved even market.
Yeah. 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 No. This is also a fun one to tackle. There are many ways to make money in the world, and I think you should deal with people that have built businesses before. If you're dealing, there are many ways to crowdsource money on the internet now and get people involved in these things. But the personal mentorship that it takes to build a business. You know, what can go wrong always goes wrong. It always takes more money. It always takes longer. And if you're dealing in a world that's a not venture capital style returns, but really nice returns, I think it's very appropriate that you're working with someone where you take enough money, but not too much money, where you've put yourself in a situation you just can't grow into the size to get the valuation and the kind of returns that are going to make your investors happy. And I probably spend a lot of my life talking people out of taking venture capital money, because not everything can be a unicorn. Now everything can be a 10x return. If you're a really small business, your goal should be, the first thing should be to be a very successful small business. And the best way to do that is to get customer money. Customer validation is what's absolutely critical here. Whether it's a technology business or you're opening a hardware store or, you know, a dealership or whatever the case may be, try to deal with experienced people. Your job is to not raise money. Your job is to build a company. But if you can find experienced people in the particular domain that you're wanting to work with, you'll be much better off.
So the synthesis of what you said is, one, bootstrapping with customer money, two, trying to get people who have experience in the domain involved in the business to get enough mentorship to be able to navigate it efficiently.
Yes. That's why you write books and I don't. You're clearer than me.
I'm also spending a lot of time on camera these days. So the other thing that actually, for those of you listening to this conversation, those of you who have not checked out OnDeck Capital, this is an interesting company, because if you're working in a domain where you have transaction revenue, so you're selling something as e-commerce, or, you know, you have lots of transactions, and you can show a track record of a certain threshold of transactions, you can actually get OnDeck Capital to lend you money, working capital essentially, that will help you bridge some of your cash flow issues. We're seeing some of that dynamic also in software as a service companies. There's, if you have a steady stream of software as a service contracts that you can show as evidence, and you do need to show some, you know, 6 months or 12 months of evidence that you have been able to get in business, you could conceivably get receivables financing or you know, contract financing based on these software as a service contracts as well. So these are some ways of bridging that, you know, that cash flow gap. It's essentially, working capital management is a nightmare for small companies.
I say no cash, no company, right?
At the same time, the cash is tight, and it's like, you know, how do you put one foot before the other?
Right.
So what about, I saw that in your portfolio, there are a bunch of software as a service companies that are related to the HR field, enterprise HR.
Yeah.
What's the thinking behind that?
That's the thing about the internet. You can run, but you can't hide. Everybody knows what you're doing. So, two I'll mention briefly. One is a company called Silk Road Technology. It's kind of a mini Workday, if people are familiar with that. It's a human capital management system for small businesses. These are businesses that could be as little as 50 people that didn't have access to a full talent management system, HR, system of record, performance compensation management, simple, easy to use, self-service. You know, so what was done on spreadsheets is very complex for small businesses, especially if there's compliance issues, can be done by them. The other company is a really interesting technical breakthrough, and I think will change the way analytics are presented. There's a company called Visier, and it's based in Vancouver, Canada. The original team did a company called Crystal Reports a number of years ago, the first OEM SQL report writer. They're brilliant people. They've come up with a way to use English as a metaphor to build analytics. You ask questions in an English business form, it gets converted to business metadata, and it gives you applications today like workforce planning and workforce analytics. And these are questions that always get answered, asked at board meetings, that someone says, I'll find somebody to go put together a spreadsheet to answer these questions for. They could be things like, tell me workers between 25 and 35 that are in China, that have experience, that are multilingual, that have served these kind of customers in these vertical markets, and none of the system of record companies have the ability to answer that analytical question that people want to know to run their businesses. And that metaphor is a platform that could be used for lots of applications. And I think the way that these things were done in large companies in the past were data warehouses that took, you know, millions of dollars and took IT departments, you know, years to set up, and then only a few power users that could work their way through a mundane SQL statement to build a report, got access to the information, and then everybody in the company fights about the information being accurate. And so in this metaphor, everything's in real time, in memory, in a computer. You're using the actual data that takes place there. And I have a couple of companies, one of them Stealth, that actually is working on working capital issues. We found that in most organizations, there's probably 10 to 15% of working capital that could be freed up if they only knew what was the truth inside of their ERP system versus their data warehouse. So very exciting field. Analytics are really across the board in almost every domain will get reinvented in the cloud with a SaaS application.
Absolutely. So obviously this is a very, you know, in our face trend right now, analytics and big data and so forth. The other one that you talked about, which has come up a little bit in our last fall programming as well, is these, you know, software that were once available only to the very, very large enterprises now being available to the very small enterprises. These under 50 people companies, even under 10, 20 people companies, are now able to access cloud technology, cloud services in all aspects of running a business, and that's one that is likely to produce a bunch of very serious scale companies.
Yeah, I have a funny story. My son is 25. He's changing jobs, and the new employer he went to, one of the world's largest software companies, said, you know, we run on Windows. And he said, I can't go to work for your company if you run on Windows. If you don't have a Mac and all the applications that I use to automate my sales and marketing and analytics process, honestly, I wouldn't come to work there. And so they're getting them a Mac computer. Sorry.
So in terms of the company folks, those of you who are listening, one of our case studies that has done phenomenally well in this catering to the very small business area, by the way, is Zoho. The case study is in the book. This company is now doing $300 million a year in revenue, and it has the entire, you know, CRM suite, a whole bunch of the mail, and you know, it's a competitor to Salesforce.com in places, to Google in places, to Microsoft in places. And so as Sridhar Vembu, the entrepreneur, puts it, they are building an operating system for running small businesses on the cloud. And the company actually is completely bootstrapped, 100% bootstrapped. There's not an ounce of financing in this company, which is a spectacular piece of achievement, I think.
Yeah.
Very hard to do, but he's done it. So what stages do you like to invest in? That would probably be the last piece of topic that we cover.
Yeah, you know, we invest 80% of the time in either seed stage, you know, really early stage. An example would be we built a company called Atheros Computer that invented Wi-Fi computing. It was essentially three people that were trying to figure out how to put a radio on a CMOS chip. There wasn't a wireless industry. So this was the investing that is brave new world, that, you know, that those kind of investments lead to incredible breakthroughs. They're super, super risky, but if you are successful, you built a new industry. And then Series A investing, which is where we like to be the first institutional investor. We work with lots of micro VCs. We work with lots of angels. You know, it's kind of all hands on deck to help the company be successful. But those are a majority of our investing. We do invest in things where we're stage agnostic, where we have deep knowledge, like in the financial services or marketing or kind of digital energy or solar as a service, because we might have missed those in the early, you know, early going. We might know the new CEO of the company or have a relationship with investors. So in the end, we're there to make money for our limited partners.
And, you know, you've been on all sides of the table for a long time. When an entrepreneur is trying to figure out whom to work with, and let's say they have the luxury, a lot of entrepreneurs do not have the luxury of choice. They kind of get whatever they get. But once, right, you know, once they've been able to figure a few things out, they actually do have some luxury of choice, because there is, at the end of the day, there is too much money chasing too few really great deals, right?
Right.
That is
right.
The structure of the industry. So what is your advice to entrepreneurs on how to select whom to work with?
You know, I think the best time to raise money is when you don't need money. And, you know, venture people, the traditional way to get to a venture person is with someone that has a trusted relationship with someone we know. If you look at the top, you know, 20 firms in the world, they do about 80% of the returns. And so you have to be intellectually honest with yourself. Do I have a company that really fits that category, or does it fit another category where you own 50% of the company, can sell it for $10 million and you make $5 million? That's a lot of money. And I think once you have intellectual honesty, the earlier you can engage in building, this is a relationship building business. You know, besides large markets, we invest in a proven team that have a track record, but it's trust. You have to trust us and we have to trust you. I used to tell people, it's a bit like, you know, being a parent of teenagers, you know, there's always something that goes wrong. I'd like to know what goes wrong. It's easy. Everybody loves good news. If I know what goes wrong, I can actually help you, and that means that you'll share with me things that really bother you. When I ask an entrepreneur, tell me the two or three things that you're most concerned about, and they're not really thoughtful answers, it tells me they really either haven't done their homework or they're not being intellectually honest about what it is they're representing.
And that trust, however, takes time to build up. What is, when you're meeting an entrepreneur for the first time, let's say they came through a trusted relationship, you were referred to this entrepreneur, but it's the first time entrepreneur, doesn't have an existing relationship with you, how do you build that trust?
You know, it just takes a time. I think that the best way to do it is, the most frustrating thing is where you kind of hit your head against the wall if you're an investor is you had a conversation and you agreed that these were the two or three things that you would really need to focus on to be successful. And they come back and see you 6 months later and they didn't do any of those things. And it's not going to magically get better by avoiding the hard, doing the hard things. Do the hard things first and really try to understand whether the fundamentals of your business is there, whether you got to go capture a million users that you can't monetize yet, or you got to go capture 10 customers at $200,000. In the end, it's kind of a simple math thing. Can you get enough customers to create a business, as an example, that can do $100 million? That's a pretty extraordinary business. If you can do that in 7 years, if you're using venture money, our money's really expensive. You don't want to use our money unless you really think you're into some accelerated growth stage. The last thing I would say is when you're dealing with people that say, I have to put $3 million to work or $50 million to work, that to me is a warning signal for a entrepreneur. The investor ought to be able to put the appropriate capital that you need to scale your business without overcapitalizing the business too soon. Nothing ruins a company worse than having too much money too soon where you haven't run enough analytical opportunities to really understand the business that you're investing in.
But that is a trend, though. There is a lot of non-disciplined or undisciplined, I don't know what is the word, investing going on right now. Companies are getting flushed with cash and developing very bad habits. And
yeah.
This is a real trend, and it's confusing a lot of entrepreneurs and the industry in general.
Well, I used to see that bumper sticker in late 2002 said, "One more bubble, please." Well, we probably are there in many respects. I think many of the companies are better, but beware, you can't put that much capital to work that quickly and have that many successful companies. It just doesn't work.
Well, and the other thing, of course, right now, because of this obsession and huge amount of media coverage around the concept of unicorns is people are obsessed with valuation. So artificially high valuation doesn't create very strong companies either.
Great point. Nothing ruins a company than getting ahead of your valuation when you show up at the next round and tell your employees your company is now worth 25% of what it was. It's almost impossible to recover from the damage that can happen. You do not build companies by valuations of having great pounds. You do it by having execution, and then the marketplace will dictate the valuation. So I would also tell entrepreneurs, even if your company is incredibly successful, really it's not about picking the highest valuation. It's about picking a fair valuation with the right amount of capital and with people you want to do business with, because you got to see them every month. If you're dreading seeing them, no valuation is going to make up for that.
All right, buddy. I know you have to run somewhere at 8:30, and thank you very much for being with us.
And thanks for letting me share some time with your listeners.
All right.